Hey, health junkies. It's time for The Health Fix. Join your host, Dr. Janine Krause, as she gives you a dose of what you need to know and do right now to take control of your health from the inside out, to rebel against aging, look damn good, fight stress, and laugh every day.
Hello there, health junkies. Welcome to another episode of The Health Fix. I'm your host, Dr. Janine Krause. Today's episode, I'm going to be going through a question that was posed to me by a listener. So the question has to do with blood sugar balance and hypothyroidism, and in particular, something called Hashimoto's hypothyroidism. And so we'll talk about Hashimoto's in particular, too, so that you get a little sense of what that is all about. So why did I think that this question was really important? Well, more than 50 million Americans have a thyroid disorder, while up to 105 million Americans have metabolic syndrome. That's a big deal. A metabolic syndrome can be things from insulin resistance, meaning that your body produces insulin from the pancreas, but it's not taking glucose into the cells for energy, so you might be chronically fatigued and gaining weight. Very common these days in age, unfortunately. So chances of having obesity and metabolic syndrome in those with thyroid disorders is increased over time, and it has to do with balancing blood sugar. Ultimately, if you don't get your blood sugar in check, you're never going to be able to fix your thyroid, and vice versa. So it goes hand in hand. And so I think it's really important to talk about this. So if you know anybody that has thyroid issues, maybe you're suspecting you do, this is a key podcast to listen to or share, because I'm going to go through some interesting components that I think a lot of people maybe don't put together. So there you have it. All right, so the question that was posed to me had to do with how to maintain blood sugar levels when this individual was having low blood sugar. So they're feeling like they have to eat all the time. Otherwise, they get shaky, they get agitated, anxious. So hypoglycemia types of symptoms, which, of course, this is very common with hypothyroidism. And it ultimately, having to eat to keep yourself feeling normal does cause weight gain over time. And that's, of course, another big pain point for a lot of patients. And yes, it's common to have more of the thyroid conditions in ladies. But you know what? I've been seeing more and more thyroid conditions in men just as serious. And so I think this is something to mention, very key right now, is that thyroid issues are not just a lady's problem. Hear me out on that. Because I think a lot of guys will kind of push off thyroid conditions and say, oh, it's not something that could be happening to me. Yes, it absolutely could be. So keep that in mind. And those of you ladies out there that are listening to this and thinking, well, I don't know if that's my husband's or boyfriend's or brother's, et cetera's issue, but it's something to keep in the back of your mind. So what is the difference between regular hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's hypothyroidism or hyperthyroidism? The official term for Hashimoto's is Hashimoto's thyroiditis, meaning inflammation of the thyroid. Therefore, an individual can have a hyperthyroid state and then convert to a hypothyroid state, or may stay in a hypothyroid state the entire time. For a lot of people, the hyperthyroid state of Hashimoto's isn't caught. Usually it's not diagnosed until the person's already gone into hypo, because let's face it, when we're in a hyperthyroid state, a lot of times, you know, our weight's staying pretty good, we have energy, but we might not realize that it's a false state of feeling good. And some people feel awful in a hyper state. I'm not going to say that you're always going to feel good in a hyper state. So, you know, it all just kind of depends, but I think it's important to mention. So what signifies Hashimoto's versus regular hypothyroidism in this case? Well, it's based on antibodies. In the case of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, these individuals have antibodies to the thyroid, so thyroglobulin antibodies, or they might have antibodies called anti-TPOs, meaning thyroid peroxidase. So this is an enzyme that you have an antibody to, and that enzyme is what converts the thyroid hormone T4 to T3. Now, if I'm losing you because I'm going into a lot of medical jargon, basically what I'm talking about here is we have hormones that come directly out of the thyroid, which is predominantly T4. And T4 gets converted to something called T3. And it gets converted by the thyroid peroxidase enzyme. And so if you have an antibody to that, you are lowering your ability to take your thyroid hormone that comes out of the thyroid and get converted to the thyroid hormone that's the most active. T3 is the most active in the body. Now, 20% of the conversion of T4 to T3 happens in the gut lining, 20% happens in the liver, and 60% happens in the rest of the tissues in the body. So if your gut and your liver are trashed, you're going to have reduced enzyme activity already. Then add that on top of having an antibody to that conversion enzyme. Anti-TPOs is the name of those. Conventional docs are not often testing these antibodies, and that's why folks have Hashimoto's and have no idea, is because typical standard medical testing is TSH, which is known as thyroid stimulating hormone, and T4, which is the thyroid that comes directly out of, or sorry, not the thyroid, the thyroid hormone that comes directly out of the thyroid. Those are most commonly tested. It's not as common to test T3 and the antibodies, as I mentioned before. So those of you who are wondering where you're at with your thyroid, if you have Hashimoto's, something of that nature, it's recommended that you ask your doc to do a full thyroid panel. And I will put that in my podcast notes at drjkrausnd.com so that you can see exactly what I just outlined in terms of questions to ask your doc. So having the antibodies to either the thyroid or the conversion from T4 to T3 enzyme signifies that you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis. Now, if you don't have any antibodies, but you have an underfunctioning thyroid, you have just hypothyroidism. So that is the distinguishing factor. So something to keep in mind there in terms of looking at these two things. Now, in terms of blood sugar, this is a little bit of a trickier thing because a lot of people are going, well, how do I even know I have blood sugar issues? Every time I go to the doctor and I've had a fasting blood test, my levels have been normal. At least so you've been told. Now, your doctor may look at a hemoglobin A1C, which is a test of your blood sugar over time. It's like 3 months of time. And that may be abnormal, may not. Usually that hemoglobin A1C is not going to trend towards abnormal until things are really bad. Same goes for the blood sugar, the fasting blood sugar in general. It usually takes about 10 years for that number to go abnormal. So that means you've got a decade of blood sugar swings of highs and lows and not responding well to carbohydrates or fasted states. That stinks. Now, I'll talk a little bit later about the blood sugar levels and how that works. And how to identify it, because of course my mission for anyone that's listening to this podcast is to be their own health advocate and to help you gather data to figure out what's going on with your body. So I will talk about how to look at that. Now, something I want you to think about here in terms of blood sugar and how connected blood sugar and thyroid issues are is that about 50% of those with thyroid issues have carbohydrate metabolism issues, so blood sugar issues. Now, those with diabetes are 3 times more likely to have a thyroid disorder. So as you can see, it's a big deal. You got to get that blood sugar under control to treat thyroid conditions. Also, if you have hypothyroidism, but you have Hashimoto's type of hypothyroidism, you absolutely need to get your blood sugar under control to be able to get your antibodies down. I have a lot of patients in my practice that I don't even start looking at their antibodies over time until I know that we're starting to get their blood sugar in control. So now, what would be some symptoms of, say, low blood sugar? This would be craving sugary foods. It would be irritability and lightheadedness if you don't get a meal or if you don't eat frequent enough. There's a dependency on caffeine oftentimes. You might need food to just get yourself a little boost of energy to keep you going. You might feel shaky, jittery, kind of like a shaking from the inside out sensation, wired but tired kind of feeling. You might have this low-level nervousness or agitation. Definitely it affects the mind, forgetfulness, mental fog, even blurred vision can go along with low blood sugar. And then, of course, another biggie is cold extremities, which we also can sometimes identify cold hands and feet with hypothyroidism. So something to think about there. Now, what does high blood sugar look like? High blood sugar looks like fatigue after meals. So imagine Thanksgiving dinner and how you feel after eating Thanksgiving dinner. That fatigue that, yeah, I need to take a nap. Now, granted, that could be some carbohydrate stuff, but it could also be just a big meal, too big of a meal. And that is something to think about. If you look at what happens with you and if you're eating a meal that has minimal carbohydrates, but you're still fatigued after the meal, it could be size of the meal, it could be lack of digestive enzymes, things of that nature. But because we're talking about symptoms of elevated blood sugar, let me continue on that. So persistent hunger can go along with elevated blood sugar, cravings for sugary food as well, but these cravings are not eliminated after you eat the sugary foods, whereas in lower blood sugar, you get your sugary food, you're good for a little bit. Now, needing desserts after meals, that's often a sign of elevated blood sugar. Your waist getting larger than your hips, there's another blood sugar issue there. Frequent urination, increased appetite and thirst, those also go along with elevated blood sugar, but also can be signs of pending diabetes or diabetes. And then difficulty losing weight can go along with elevated blood sugar. Now, I've also seen difficulty losing weight going along with low blood sugar, but that typically is because this person is overeating to try to compensate with the blood sugar lows. So there you have it. So if you have any of those symptoms consistently, you want to start collecting data to determine what's going on with your body to get that blood sugar in check, because you can have absolutely normal blood sugar. You can have an absolutely normal thyroid, but if you've got blood sugar swings going on and you've got any of those symptoms I just mentioned, you're kind of a ticking time bomb for issues down the road. So you might think, oh, I'm good. Just take a look. Do a little investigation. This is why I'm a huge advocate of journaling your health data for the day and how you're feeling. All right. So how really do we convert into having blood sugar issues that cause thyroid issues or thyroid issues that cause blood sugar issues? Because I think it's somewhat of a chicken or egg issue here. A lot of the times, if we look at the root cause of thyroid issues in general, we're looking at Stress, and infections. Stress and infections are kind of the root of all illness in my mind, or the root of all evil, if you look at it. Why? Because stress messes with our blood sugar. The higher our blood sugar goes, the more that all those little bugs in the body like to take over and create low-level chronic infections. Also, the higher the blood sugar goes, the lower our immunity goes. So we're more susceptible to infections. I've talked in this podcast about chronic mono, which is a real thing. I see it a lot. It's chronic fatigue, lymph node swelling in the neck, persistent tight neck issues, sometimes chronic nerve-like pain. So that's chronic mono. Chronic cytomegalovirus, also chronic Lyme, can look like that too. Also, probably more prevalent than some of the mono, the Lyme, and the cytomegalovirus is gut infections. I would say probably the majority of the folks I see with hypothyroid conditions, or even Hashimoto's for that matter, have had some sort of parasite in the gut, such as Blastocystis hominy, or even yeast or overgrowth of bacterial, so SIBO, so small intestine bowel overgrowth. It's a thing. It's real. I see it a lot. A lot of us are walking around with guts that are just not functioning optimally and also have low-grade infections. So you want to look at these things as a component of your investigation into your blood sugar, because the gut is vital and your immune system is vital to helping to get your blood sugar back in order and getting your thyroid back in order. So never ignore the gut and never ignore any possible infections. So how do you go about that? We have beautiful things like Viome, V-I-O-M-E, that you can get a test kit online these days, and you just swab your toilet paper. Super easy. You don't even have to play with your poop. That's one way you could come to a naturopathic doctor like myself or a functional medicine doctor and get a stool sample, and we can run it through a company like Doctor's Data. And there's also possibilities for looking at blood in terms of chronic mono, Lyme, all of that. All of these things can be tested. You just need to know where to go. So naturopathic doctors, functional medicine doctors, or mymedilab.com. You could just go to that website and order the test up yourself. Go to a lab and have it drawn yourself. It's a DIY world here. And the way the healthcare system is, I advocate that you take care of yourself and take matters into your own hands. If you're not getting the healthcare that you need, definitely recommend that you have somebody to help guide you. But at least if you're in the data collection state and you can't get anyone to draw these labs for you, go for it. In terms of insurance coverage, because that's always a big question for a lot of folks, usually stool testing in terms of the more advanced stool testing is not covered by insurance. You're looking at around $300. Viome is cheaper. I like Doctor's Data just because they do a couple of things to tell you how you break down the stool. And that in addition to the bacteria, yeast, etc., parasites that are on the gut lining. So that being said, there's all of that. I will put that in my DrJKrausND.com podcast notes. So head over there if you want info in that department. Now, moving forward, stress. Let's talk about stress for a minute. You can even test, by the way, how stressed you are with saliva cortisol and blood, for that matter. You can do an AM cortisol, too, to see what's going on. Wish you could do blood tests all day long to see where your cortisol levels are at. If you had someone who was willing to draw your blood and keep running it through, you probably could, but conventional labs aren't going to do it and insurance isn't going to cover that. But it's an intriguing thing if you know someone who works in a lab. Anyway, stress. Increased stress causes increased cortisol, which increased cortisol is going to increase inflammatory proteins in the body. What does that do? It increases the possibility of thyroid antibodies. It's going to increase fatigue. It's going to increase mood swings. Because anytime stress goes up, your blood sugar goes up. And this can be a really big deal for a lot of folks. So I'm going to get into it in a second. Let's talk a little bit about the stress response. So when you have more stress, your adrenal glands, those are your glands that release epinephrine, so adrenaline, they're going to kick out your fight or flight response. You're going to have lightheadedness, you might have shakiness, you might be irritable. These kind of things are not ideal, but they're one of the things to help keep us aware of our surroundings in the protective state. Unfortunately, a lot of us are stressed all the time, and this is something that's happening multiple times throughout the day. Now, those adrenal glands that are going to release your adrenaline are also going to release cortisol. Cortisol is going to tell your liver to produce more glucose, so more sugar. And so now you're going to have more sugar going into the bloodstream. At the same time, your pituitary gland is up in your brain. It's going to release growth hormone. Your pancreas is going to release glucagon, which is more or less the message to your liver and even to your muscles to release glucose. So you've got your liver releasing glucose, you've got muscles releasing glucose. Why? Because functionally, if we are trying to get away from a bear, we need to have sugar in our bloodstream to sustain our run, our escape away from this particular creature. However, for many of us, that creature just never goes away. It's like on our back all the time and we can't escape it. And so we are constantly puffing out cortisol and increased blood sugar after we perhaps just ate some granola with our yogurt for breakfast. Or maybe we just grabbed a banana on the way to work or a granola bar on the way to work or a donut for that matter. Well, what I just mentioned are very high carbohydrate items. So if you're putting carbohydrates into the body first thing off the bat in the morning and you're already stressed, you're going to double your blood sugar, which is also going to cause a double drop in the blood sugar. So blood sugar is going to go up naturally because we're in a stressed state, and then compound that with what you ate, and now you've got double what would normally happen, and then what's going to happen? What goes up must come down, law of gravity, and your cortisol and blood sugar. You're going to have a hypoglycemic event, meaning your blood sugar is going to go low. And for a lot of people, you have a roller coaster like this all day long based on what you're eating. So I highly recommend for anybody who's dealing with blood sugar issues to make sure that you are noting what you have for breakfast. Because naturally, we produce cortisol in the morning. It's what wakes us up. We produce cortisol. We're actually dumping a little bit of liver and muscle glycogen. So it's going into the system from the pancreas. What's going to happen? It's going to dump glucose in. And so we're going to have naturally a little bit of glucose going into the bloodstream in the morning to get us up, to get us going, to give us energy for the day. Top that off with some stress and a banana, and you've got the trifecta for a very high blood sugar and a reactive drop. So these are things to think about. What you eat in the morning is going to predict the rest of your day because your pancreas is going to gauge the amount of insulin it's going to release based on the first meal of the day or its previous meal. So keep that in mind too. So if your blood sugar goes pretty high and you produce a bunch of insulin, you might have a bigger drop. Or if you're insulin resistant, you might end up with sustained elevated blood sugar for a while, and you're not going to feel good either way. So these are things to think about, and this is why I love testing blood sugar first thing in the morning. So using a glucometer to test in the morning and then test 1 to 2 hours after meals to see how these foods affect you. Data is key here because you can subjectively think in your head, okay, I think this is what happened. But when you have the data, the objective data right in front of you, you can't argue it. You know what's happening then. I'm going to talk about glucometers here in a little bit. Now, one thing to note, if anyone's had gastric bypass surgery, sugars are absorbed even faster, which can stimulate excess insulin production, and that can even cause more issues of reactive hypoglycemia, especially after breakfast time or in the morning time. So keep that in mind if you've had any gastric bypass surgeries. You're kind of set up for having troubles with blood sugar. So even more of a point to get this in check. Now, there is a concept in terms of folks that might have problems with digestion of certain sugars, such as fructose and galactose. Fructose is fruit sugar, or it could be the fructose in the high fructose corn syrup, so another reason why you shouldn't have frankenfoods and processed foods. And then galactose is a milk sugar, and these guys can cause some hypoglycemia events if someone eats these particular foods. Now, the individual that I spoke with on my podcast question was given a low fructose diet to try to counter her symptoms, and it didn't work out very well for this individual, but it may be an issue with some folks. I highly recommend if you think that you have an issue with fructose or galactose, this would be time to go see a functional medicine doc or a naturopathic doctor to work on that specific diet. I will be honest that I don't see that as the cause as much as it's just pure needing to work on stress management and working on blood sugar balance. Now, there is a case in which one can have a tumor known as an insulinoma, and this is an insulin-producing tumor that can live in the pancreas, and it will cause issues of hormone production with the pituitary and adrenal glands and ultimately cause some pretty severe hypoglycemia. So this is a rare condition, but it is a possibility, and typically folks with insulinomas are going to have high blood sugars early in the morning after fasting overnight and might have some pretty serious issues that are going to be more frequent and severe of symptoms. So this is the person that's going to go quasi-comatose without blood sugar. So might look like having diabetes. So that's a very advanced condition, not something that I want folks to be panicking about because usually it's more of the more simple fix the blood sugar balance. I say simple. It's not that simple. Let's just say the more common fix the blood sugar balance and not something drastic as a tumor, but worth noting. All right. So the big deal that happens in the body for blood sugar to affect the thyroid is that we're going to affect signaling to the brain and then to the thyroid when blood sugars are high or low. And in particular, with low blood sugar, a lot of folks are going to have repeated cortisol release, which is going to cause, of course, a suppression of the pituitary, which then is going to suppress the thyroid, because the pituitary in the brain is a signaling. It's like mission control for telling your thyroid to create thyroid hormone, that it needs to get some metabolic activity going in the body. So chronic cortisol release is going to suppress the thyroid. Now, in terms of chronic high blood sugar, that's also going to mess with the pituitary gland, because we're going to have elevated cortisol. So elevated cortisol is going to go along with elevated epinephrine, and this is going to interfere with the pituitary gland signaling the thyroid as well. And so the thyroid's not going to release enough hormone. So a lot of times people are going to think when they have hypothyroidism that it's the thyroid that's the problem. That's not always the case. It could very well be the pituitary gland in the brain causing issues. Most of the time, when folks have absolutely normal thyroid-stimulating hormone levels, so your doc looks at your labs and they're like, your TSH is fine. Your T4 is low normal, but it's fine. That is when you've got a pituitary issue. And so I look at labs and I look at symptoms. Symptoms trump what labs say, because sometimes people can have absolutely normal labs, but their pituitary is suppressing their thyroid function. And that can happen in high and low blood sugar states. Now, what happens exactly when your thyroid is underfunctioning in terms of blood sugar? Like, how does that feed back? So your low thyroid function is going to slow the rate of sugar uptake by your cells. So the blood sugar is going to stay in your bloodstream longer. The other thing that's going to happen even before the sugar gets to your cells is that we're going to have a decreased rate of sugar absorption in your gut. So keep in mind, if you remember from earlier, I know I'm throwing a lot of information at you, your thyroid hormone is in charge of 20% of conversion of T4 to T3. So we have T4 going into your gut, and it gets converted to T3 at 20% on your gut lining via the enzyme thyroid peroxidase. Now, if we're going to have issues of glucose absorption across the gut, it's going to be because we have low thyroid hormone getting to the gut. So if you have decreased rates of sugar, otherwise known as glucose, coming across your gut and getting into your bloodstream, you're then going to have a slower rate of that sugar, otherwise known as glucose, getting into your cells. So then if we're not getting the signaling of glucose rising in the cells, we're going to have a slower response of insulin to blood sugar. So ultimately, your cells are not going to be as sensitive to your sugars. They're not going to take in the sugar for energy as fast as someone else, which is pretty much the hallmark of fatigue and why someone's fatigued and not getting energy from their food when they have hypothyroidism. So the terrible part about this, or maybe the side effect of not getting energy in from sugar, is that if your cells don't get the glucose they need for energy, especially your brain, you're going to have a release of cortisol and a stress response. So adrenaline gets released, cortisol gets released, and now we suppress the thyroid. So what we've got here, unfortunately, is this terrible kind of negative feedback loop that we don't want to happen. Because if you're eating carbohydrates, you're getting the sugar into your system, but it's at a slower rate, so your body doesn't really recognize it as much. You're going to have glucose that builds up in your bloodstream that's not utilized for energy. And at the same time, your body doesn't recognize that there's glucose already in your bloodstream, and it creates a panic response. So you dump more glucose into your bloodstream from your muscles and from your liver. And so we have all of that happening. At the same time, our thyroid is being suppressed. What happens? That glucose is going to sit in the bloodstream, turn to fat, cause your triglycerides to go up, and sugar for prolonged periods in the bloodstream does cause damage to your arteries. So we've got a lot of different things happening there. And as this happens over time, we're going to irritate the gut, we're going to irritate the lungs, we're going to irritate the brain, and then we're going to mess with all kinds of hormone levels. Why? Because the imbalances of blood sugar are going to fatigue your adrenal glands. You're going to mess up your detoxification pathways, you're going to impair your metabolism. All of these things which further weaken your thyroid function. So now that it sounds like doom and gloom, it's just that I want folks to understand this is why thyroid conditions are so devastating to folks. It messes with so many functions of the body. So big deal here, got to get the stress under control, got to watch how many carbs you are eating. I'm not a proponent, if you've listened to any of my podcasts, you'll know I'm not a proponent of a keto diet. I am more of a proponent of eating foods closest to nature and watching how many carbs that you are intaking. Everybody has their individual number of carbs that they can tolerate. It's a carb tolerance, if you will. And the best way to know that is to test your blood sugar. You gotta know where things are at. So let's talk about blood sugar. The normal range for fasting blood glucose is between 75 and 95. 100 is really kind of considered the cutoff for normal. I really, really like folks to be somewhere between 75 and 85 to 90. Once folks are in the mid-90s for too long on fasting blood tests when I'm looking over and over again, or even when they're looking by testing blood sugar, it's just the finger poke type of test, it's going to predict that they might have blood sugar issues in the future. And so watch where your blood sugars are at on the average. Now, being in the 70 to 80 range is normal if someone's on a really low carb diet. So keep that in mind. Even though I'm saying I like 75 to like 90, in the 70s isn't horrible. I don't want people below the 70s. I especially don't want people down into the 50s. That is not good. That's a low blood sugar. We got to figure that out kind of state. Now, I want folks to test when they first wake up in the morning and see where their blood sugar is. And I also want folks to test 1 to 2 hours after a meal. And in particular, if you want to get super nitpicky, eat one meal, like exactly the same meal, eat it and test it 1 hour after, and eat the same meal and test 2 hours after. So like eat the same thing for lunch and dinner and test 1 hour and then test 2 hours after and see what you got in terms of blood sugar. Now, keep in mind, that's probably not the 100% accurate data because you might have higher cortisol based on the evening if you're more stressed, things of that nature. But it is one way to see how a particular meal affects you. If you want to be 100% pure in your experimentation, eat the same thing for lunch 2 days in a row. Test 1 hour after one day and test 2 hours after the next day. And then you'll see what's going on more legitimately because, yes, your cortisol levels may flux throughout the day based on when you're stressed. Sometimes I'll see folks have low cortisol in the morning, have high cortisol in the afternoon, like 4 or 5 o'clock when they get home from work, if that's when their stress levels peak. So always a good idea to get a cortisol saliva test just to see where things are at. These tests are only like a little bit over $100 and worth it. And you can resubmit these to insurance and get insurance to pay for it. So things to think about there. Now, you look at your blood sugar either 1 to 2 hours after a meal, and you don't want it to be going much up over 126. That's kind of your cutoff where we would diagnose something as being diabetic. Ultimately, most people are about 100 in terms of milligram per deciliter of sugar after a meal. If you're spiking up over 100, then you're probably having some blood sugar issues, meaning dysglycemia. That's the fancy word for it, just in case you wanted to have the fancy $5 word, dysglycemia. So for those of you who are hypoglycemic, your goal is to keep your blood sugar at least above 70 to 75 every single day. You might have to eat small frequent meals, and that is what I did with the individual that I was answering the question for in this podcast. We talked about having meals every 2 to 3 hours just to keep the energy supply going while we're figuring out getting her stress under control, because she did have a saliva cortisol test that showed she's got some imbalances, and in fact, she's more on the adrenal hypofunctioning state. And so those adrenals will puff out cortisol whenever they want to when they're stressed. And the more depleted they are, the more the, let's put it, derangement of release of cortisol and blood sugar. So you got to be careful with that. So this is why stress management is absolutely key, and taking care of yourself is absolutely key, because it affects your blood sugar and will affect your overall outcome and getting your thyroid in check. All right, so glucometer. What kind of glucometer do I recommend to my patients? I typically recommend something called the Contour Next. It's like $9. The most expensive thing is the strips. Those are $43. If you have a doc on board, you can have your doc prescribe the test strips. Unfortunately, they'll have to prescribe you a glucose test kit that's going to be covered by your insurance. So you might not be able to do the Contour Next or the same strips, but hey, if you can get your insurance to cover it, that is great, especially if they use the ICD-10 code dysglycemia. That is an insurance reimbursable code, as is hypoglycemia. Hypoglycemia is E16.9. There you go. Tell your doc. Dysglycemia, I don't have memorized, but it's also an ICD-9. If you Google ICD-9. That's old school. We are at ICD-10. These are insurance codes, by the way, folks. So ICD-10 dysglycemia, Google it, you'll get the number. You can tell your doc that too if you want to make it super easy on them. But Contour Next is the one I use, and the strips are about $43. The machine itself is $9. And then I will use lancets, because you got to poke yourself. You got to make yourself bleed here. And I use CareTouch multicolor lancets. They're like $11 on Amazon. So you could be all set up with Prime in 2 days. You have all your stuff, and you could start testing and seeing what's going on. Now, with figuring out your glucose tolerance, you also need to figure out your carbohydrate tolerance. And I love folks to eat a potato and test 1 to 2 hours after the potato and see what your blood sugar does. If it goes beyond 120 milligrams per deciliter, so 120, that means you are not tolerating that particular food well. I highly recommend testing sweet potato, testing tortillas, testing bread, test your favorite foods, test an apple, see what happens. It's eye-opening. Every single person is different. There's no one-size-fits-all situation here. I'm very sorry about that, American Diabetes Association. It is not a one-size-fits-all situation. So you've got to get your data. So if you're thinking you've got some carb issues, or if you're just curious, I highly recommend getting a glucometer and start poking yourself. Highly recommend to use the lancet on the sides of your middle finger pad when you're poking yourself, because if you use the middle of the finger pad, it does not feel good later on the day if you've got a type. So sides of finger pads, and make sure they're nice and warm, or just give your finger a good little massage so there's lots of blood there, so you make sure that you get your blood there. All right. So I've kind of went through how to test and how to look at things. What I didn't mention is first thing in the morning, blood sugar testing. I typically recommend after at least 10 hours of fasting. 12 is good too, but 10 to 12, look in that time frame. I am a huge proponent of not eating for 12 hours. So go to bed 7 p.m. No, don't go to bed at 7 p.m. That's really early. Stop eating at 7 p.m. and don't eat again till after 7 a.m. kind of concept. Let the gut rest. The gut needs some rest. In terms of intermittent fasting, yes, it works for some folks. In terms of hypoglycemia and trying to figure out your blood sugar, don't mess with intermittent fasting at this point. It's going to throw things off. You need to get your blood sugar in check first, then you can start to play. Figure out how your body deals with blood sugar. What is happening? So after at least 10 to 12 hours of fasting in the morning, you know I prefer 12, test your blood sugar and see before eating anything. What is happening? Note what time it is, because 6 to 8 a.m. is when cortisol is supposed to be the highest. Some people don't produce a lot of cortisol in the morning. So something to think about there. I do recommend pairing this data with your saliva cortisol too. So keep that in mind, because that can tell you if you don't produce a lot of cortisol in the morning and your blood sugars tend to not be an issue as much in the morning, but they're a huge issue in the afternoon. Okay, there you go. Why? Because maybe you're not producing enough blood sugar in the morning, or not blood sugar, cortisol in the morning, and you're producing more cortisol in the afternoon. It's possible. So something to think about there. But make a journal. Figure out how every single carbohydrate behaves in your body. Now, one thing to look at, if you test yourself and you see these high numbers coming up, what you're going to want to do is you definitely want to take action and reduce the amount of carbohydrate. I don't want you to panic and take it completely out. Because a lot of times if you have, say, a cup of cereal in the morning and you're noticing that your sugars go up to 120 or above, okay, cut that cereal down to half a cup. Maybe combine it with something like a little bit of ground turkey and veggies, if you absolutely have to still have your cereal because you love it. Or, you know, play with it. There's ideas. And I could probably do a whole podcast on that. I'm not going to go into food options and things of that nature right now. I will give a basic one in terms of what I explain to the patient that I, or to the question, the gal who asked the question for this podcast. So here's a big thing to think about in terms of carbohydrate impact on food. Eating a carb with a protein can slow down the glycemic impact of the food. Also eating a fat with a protein and a carb. So the idea is a more balanced meal. Ideally, if you're looking at a slowing of an impact, if you want a potato, 8 ounces of potato to 4 ounces of steak would be that 2-to-1 ratio to try to slow down the glycemic impact. For some people, this works. For other people, it doesn't. This is why individual testing is absolutely key. I also highly recommend not having sweets less than 3 hours before bed, because insomnia for a lot of people is a blood sugar imbalance issue and can really be related to the body having a spike before bed and a drop mid-sleep, like 1 a.m., 2 a.m., where your blood sugar is dropping so low it's waking you up. And in some cases, it wakes folks up to have to go eat. In other cases, it just wakes folks up. And so insomnia can be related here too, and something to think about. Caffeine is also going to mess with your blood sugar because caffeine increases cortisol in the body. If you have blood sugar imbalances, caffeine should not be part of your day. I highly recommend for some folks even to cut out the black tea and the green tea. Go to herbal teas. Now, gluten, dairy, soy, corn, and yeast, these are all inflammatory foods. For folks with thyroid conditions, these foods can be big issues and in particular can mess with blood sugar because any food insensitivity, food irritant can cause blood sugar to rise because cortisol rises because it's a stress response that's provoked in the body. So I do recommend if you're having trouble after taking some of my suggestions to get your blood sugar in check, get a food sensitivity test, see what's going on in that case. Breakfast. I think it's important to eat breakfast for folks that have blood sugar imbalances. And in particular, at the beginning when you're trying to figure this out. That's why I said intermittent fasting can be tricky, probably not my number one go-to. So eating breakfast, because we know that cortisol is typically higher for most folks in the morning because it wakes us up, and sometimes the mornings are the most stressful time for folks, try and have your least amount of carbs in the morning might be the way to go. It all depends. Now, this is why testing your blood sugar is key, but also considering having your cortisol tested. And testing your blood sugar before you eat, so upon waking, and then 1 to 2 hours after breakfast will give you a really good sense of how your body deals with what foods you typically eat. And I would play with what you typically eat first and then start to adjust. That being said, what did I tell the person that I spoke to about this podcast question? Well, because this guy was having some pretty frequent low blood sugar symptoms, I recommended starting the morning off with a higher protein and fat breakfast. So if you eat meat, you could do like ground turkey, veggies, put a little bit of avocado or or avocado oil, you know, cook it with an oil so you've got a little bit of the good fat, and rely on a little bit more of the veggies for your carb in the meal, and use the ground turkey in that sense. Now, say you're vegan, no problem. You could use sunflower seeds along with veggies and have a scramble with the sunflower seeds. They make a vegan egg, quote, fake egg dish, and you could put turmeric in it and make it even look like eggs in this case and see how that does. I'm not a huge proponent of soy for protein source in terms of vegetarians and vegans who have thyroid and blood sugar issues because soy is an irritant. So that is why I'm mentioning those options. Now, if you are having blood sugar lows quite a bit, you're gonna want to make sure you're eating every 2 to 3 hours. But making sure that, because your body's gonna ask you for a carb-based food, a lot of times I'll pair it with protein, kind of like what I was mentioning, 2-to-1 carb to protein or carb to fat. Dates, yes, there's higher carb in there, but dates and walnuts, dates and almonds, I will often have folks pair like a date and a couple almonds, or a date and a walnut, and see how that does for your snack, because it'll give you enough sugar, but it'll also give a little bit of fat to blunt the effect, and we see how the body responds. That's one option. Things like nut butters and a little bit of apple or pear, or you know, like a quarter of it, would be another option to see how that goes, because the nuts and walnuts and seeds do have some carbs. So things to think about. It's just looking at what you've got on your plate, looking to make sure that you've got enough good fiber to also help blunt the effect of the glucose. Eating closest to nature is always king. Frankenfoods, processed foods are going to have hidden sugar. They're also going to have irritants that the body doesn't necessarily know what to do with, especially food agents like natural flavors. Your body doesn't know what to do with that, even though it says natural. It doesn't matter. It's can be irritating in that case. So to sum up this whole podcast, there are connections between blood sugar imbalances and thyroid issues. Most of the reason for the weight gain with hypothyroidism is usually because of a blood sugar issue, and that's going to end up messing with your hormones, things of that nature, which is going to make the weight hard to come off. And that's the struggle with hypothyroidism. So getting your blood sugar in check, working on your gut, working on just getting to know your body better is going to be key for sleuthing this whole mess out. So I hope that I've given you a little sense of what to do, how to get started to figure out how carbs work well or don't work well with your body, and what to do, patterning. So I'm going to put all of my details in terms of the labs, things of that nature, in my podcast notes at drjkrausnd.com, so that you can see exactly how I work with patients in terms of helping to get the blood sugar and the thyroid back online, in addition to gut health as well. I'll give you the full protocol and just give you guidelines in terms of what you can do to get started. Keep in mind that it's not a one-size-fits-all solution. You have to get the data, otherwise you're stabbing in the dark. And you can do this. It's easy to do once you get set up and you start to get to know your body better, because those who know their body better are going to be able to self-advocate for themselves so much better. All right, folks, keep those questions coming. I'm enjoying answering them, and I'm hoping that you guys are able to share this information. Give me a 5-star rating on iTunes, please. I'd love to get more information out. I want to share and help folks advocate and get themselves as healthy as they can possibly be. Alrighty, you've survived another episode of The Health Fix. I'm your host, Dr. Janine Krause. Have a great day, whatever you're doing. Hey everybody, Dr. Janine Krause here. If you liked what you heard today, then head over to drjkrausnd.com to find my free resources and information to know when I post something new that's juicy that you might want to check out. Plus, head over to where you get your podcasts and like, subscribe, and write a review to help get the word out about me and help others at the same time to find me. It really does help, and I really appreciate all of your reviews.